Now we're going to begin how the U.S. lost the Second World War by taking a look once again at the Christian West concept. This is carried from the book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch. The Christian West concept was a Third Reich survival concept, a contingency plan for surviving military defeat by the Third Reich. It provided for a Hitlerless Reich to join with the United States, Britain, and France in an anti-Soviet alliance with this Hitlerless Reich as the keystone of this European anti-Soviet alliance. And this would entail a very strong Germany, ultimately reaching well into Eastern Europe, to act as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. As we've looked at in the past, this concept, quite obviously, whether it was agreed to during the war, as I suspect, or whether it was agreed to after the war, as is a matter of history, that is obviously the seed concept for NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and also, incidentally, the Marshall Plan as well. We're going to take a look at the Christian West concept, because in order to understand how the U.S. lost the Second World War, we're going to have to take a detailed look at events in Germany during and after World War II. We are then going to jump to a brief review of an article by Carl Oglesby from Covert Action Information Bulletin, this dealing with the Galen Organization, and we're going to take a look at Reinhard Galen's view during World War II of the need to ally with the Western powers, that is to say the United States and Britain and France, as a means of regaining Germany's lost territories. It is only too apparent that the Christian West concept was being seen by Galen and his Third Reich masters as a means for ultimately regaining the territory that was taken from them during World War II. We're going to go at considerable length, the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the Third Reich's plans to have both the German government and the Nazi Party go underground in a decentralized, cellularly organized fashion. Whereas the Nazi Party itself and the German government was highly centralized, the Nazi contingency plan for going underground was to decentralize as much as possible, and beyond that, to organize along very small cells, which would be kept underground and ignorant of each other, except for a central coordinating structure, for as long as was deemed necessary. These cells were to be controlled by the Gestapo, and following an examination of the Nazi Party and the Third Reich government's plans for decentralized cellular organization underground as a survival concept, we're going to take a look at the Third Reich's plans for training future leadership for underground work, and specifically we're going to take a look at the Deutsche Heimschulen, which were used to initially to train saboteurs for the Third Reich. However, after the decision was made to prepare for defeat, these Deutsche Heimschulen were used to train future underground workers, young Germans, young Nazis, who would be placed in underground situations both in Germany and abroad. And it's worth noting, and it's a very important thing to understand, that provisions were being made for Third Reich activity for decades underground after World War II. By the way, this book, The Nazis Go Underground, is not very well known, but it was highly respected at the time of its publication in 1944. It is drawn on resistance and intelligence material that was communicated to the Western Allies during the Second World War. Following a look at the proposed activities, or the activities and proposed future for the graduates of the Deutsche Heimschulen, we're going to take a look at the German Ausland Organisation. That was an organization, a Third Reich organization of Germans living abroad, which basically functioned as an extension of the Third Reich abroad. The decentralized underground contingency plan being developed by the Third Reich called for large portions of the Third Reich to be sent abroad and to work alongside of the Ausland Organisation in foreign countries after the war. The Deutsche Heimschulen and the Ausland Organisation were seen as major elements for the decentralized, cellularly organized Third Reich survivalist contingency plans. And after that, we're going to take a look at the profound role that Spain was foreseen as playing in the post-World War II underground Third Reich. Spain, of course, became a fascist country in the late 1930s as a result of General Francisco Franco's conquest of the loyalist forces in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. His conquest liberally aided not only by Hitler and Mussolini with direct military aid, but also by American and British industrialists and financiers who refused to permit arms shipments again to the loyalist forces. The Falange, a dominant Spanish fascist organization, was used by the Third Reich, and in particular, one of the most important figures in the Third Reich and one of the least known figures, a German general named Wilhelm von Vaupel, F-A-U-P-E-L. He was in many ways the dominant force behind Francisco Franco, viewed by many skilled observers at the time as the real power behind the throne, so to speak, of Franco's Spain. This individual, von Vaupel, very closely connected to the IG Farben Nazi chemical cartel, and an individual who was profoundly involved with the successful triumph of fascism in Spain, and beyond that, an individual who had fashioned the Falange as an organ of Third Reich espionage and sabotage and foreign activity, both in Spain and all around the world where Spanish culture was influential, primarily Latin America, but also in places like the Philippines. We will go into how Spain remained connected to other parts of the world that had previously been parts of the Spanish Empire, because it's important to understand that by way of evaluating the Third Reich's post-World War II survival contingency plans. Now, I can appreciate that many of you will see this as irrelevant. It happened a long time ago. We don't need to know about that now. There's so much going on now. Yes, indeed. There is a great deal going on now, but it is vital if we're going to assess the present, anticipate, and adequately deal with the future for us to understand the past. And with the European currencies, the weaker ones, that is, fluctuating wildly as the Deutsche Mark remains strong, the Germans... by the way, for the benefit of people who eventually hear this by tape, I am recording this on September 20th of 1992. The pound, the lira, and other European currencies are in very bad shape. The Deutsche Mark remains the strongest currency, arguably, in the world because of very high German interest rates to avoid inflation following the reunification of Germany. And just today, as I said, on September 20th, 1992, France voted to ratify the Maastricht Treaty, a major step toward the final reunification of Europe into a single economic and political entity with a single currency that eventually, in all probability, will include the former Warsaw Pact states and the newly independent republics of the former Soviet Union. That will be, as I said, by far and away the most powerful political and economic entity in the world, and it already is and will be for the foreseeable future dominated by Germany. This is a profound achievement, one which I view as extremely unpleasant, but at the same time it is a remarkable human achievement. And in order to understand how it happened and what we are actually dealing with, it is vital to go into the past. After having examined in detail the Third Reich plans to go underground, we are going to begin moving forward into the future, and we're going to take a look at the successful fulfillment of these Third Reich plans to continue functioning underground, and we're going to jump to another very important, highly respected, though largely unknown book written long ago. This one is called The New Germany and the Old Nazis by a prominent German anti-fascist and scholar named T.H. Tetens, T-E-T-E-N-S. This book, now The Nazis Go Underground, was written in 1944. This book was written in 1961, and the events that we're going to look at this evening happened in between 1950 and 1953, most of them in 53, 9 years, almost a full decade after The Nazis Go Underground was published, and we are going to see an absolutely eerie realization of the events being proposed by the Germans in 1944, reported by Kurt Rees in 1944, and it will be only too apparent in this evening's broadcast and in the remaining broadcasts of this archive show that these plans were fulfilled. We're going to take a look at the Naumann coup attempt in the Federal Republic of Germany. It was not formally incorporated at this time, but perhaps it was at this time. In any event, a coup was staged by a former key aide to Third Reich propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, a fellow named Werner Naumann, N-A-U-M-A-N-N, and Naumann was leading a coup attempt against the Adenauer government, Adenauer himself, a Third Reich collaborator and an individual who oversaw the reinstitution of Third Reich alumni and most of the Third Reich principals in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Still, that was not good enough for Werner Naumann, and the British had become aware. The British occupation forces had become aware of the Naumann coup. They foiled it. However, the Naumann coup plotters were viewed as heroes by the Germans. The British were viewed as enemies for having exposed this, and beyond that, the Naumann coup plot was seen by the Germans and the Adenauer government in particular as an attempt to foil the ratification of the European Defense Community Treaty, or EDC, which was seen in 1953, which was when the Naumann coup took place, as the first step toward full political unification of Europe, which is now taking place, as I speak, almost 40 years later. We're going to take a look at what lay behind the Naumann coup, and basically what lay behind it was a worldwide decentralized Nazi organization, highly coordinated, very well financed, very closely connected to the top economic, top corporate, and political leadership of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. And we're going to take a look at how the Naumann plotters represented the total fulfillment of the Third Reich's plans to go underground, reported by Kurt Reese almost a decade earlier. The Naumann coup plotters eventually were able to go free. They were not prosecuted. Their attorneys put pressure on the Adenauer government to let them go because otherwise the, quote, true background of the case, unquote, would be openly discussed. They were released. The highest court in Germany, in the Federal Republic, turned them loose. And it eventually came out again that this group, the Naumann coup plotters, part of the main above-ground element of a worldwide Nazi underground, very well organized, very well financed, very close to the main corporate powers of Germany and the political leadership of the Adenauer government. This group was intending to restore the Reich in its entirety. Last week, we took a look at how the corporations that had backed the Third Reich were put back in power. Attempts to decartelize Germany were frustrated by many of the American corporations who had dealt so intimately with them. Well, the Naumann coup plotters had enormous backing, and the headquarters for the Naumann, or the force behind the Naumann coup plotters, was nothing less than a Nazi party in exile, which was in Madrid, Spain. There was a leadership group, sort of a political mafia, which operated West Germany by remote control. It was called the Führungsring. And this particular group, the Naumann group, and the Nazi Party in Exile were based in Madrid, Spain. That is precisely where the Third Reich, as reported by Kurt Reese in 1944, was planning on locating the center of their underground activities. And here, in a book published in 1961, we will examine events from 1953, almost a decade after the Reese book was published, and we shall see that, in fact, these plans were realized. We're going to take a look at the functions of the Führungsring, how it was able to infiltrate West Germany to the highest extent. We're going to take a look at some of the functionings of the post-World War II Nazi underground all over the world, in Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. Some of the activities of Colonel Otto Skorzeny and Hans Ulrich Rudel, the German Luftwaffe pilot, World War II hero. And we're going to take a look at the direct and profound connections of the Naumann plotters to not only the Nazi Party in Exile headquarters in Madrid, but also to the Adenauer government, which they basically controlled. And we're going to read directly from a captured document. And by the way, the Naumann coup and the forces behind it is extremely well documented. It was reported in major American papers, major British papers, major German papers, such as the Frankfurter Rundschau and the Stuttgarter Nachrichten. Unfortunately, history has not taken note of this. We're going to touch briefly on why not. But we are going to read directly from a Madrid circular letter that was developed and distributed by the Nazi Party in Exile in Madrid, which analyzes the success of the Third Reich in going underground, the extent to which it controlled the Adenauer government, and its plan for the future. As William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past, and I'm afraid that if we do not study the past, an awful lot of us are going to be dead and buried if we aren't already. And again, I can appreciate that perhaps people are frustrated. Some listeners might be frustrated that we're not moving ahead with current events. We are. And I think people will be able to see some of the events currently overtaking the world with a new and chilling perspective, albeit a more important perspective, as we examine what happened in Germany during the post-World War II period. Another headline which you can see just this past week, Germany has begun to deport ethnic Romanians and gypsies in order to help alleviate the dire economic conditions in Eastern Germany. Note, too, that East Germany, the former East Germany, is in very bad economic shape. So is much of the rest of the world. There may very well be a world financial collapse. It was the social dislocation produced by the Great Depression, which led in many ways to the popular acceptance of fascism the first time around. My feeling is that a repeat of such a collapse may very well have the same effect this time. But again, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And if people think that is so much malarkey, well, stick around. And I think in this evening's installment of RFA 37, and in weeks to come, you will achieve a new perspective on world events, a subjectively unpleasant one, I must confess. Going over this material was, for me, pretty depressing, and I'm pretty toughened at this point to the depressing subject material that I've been researching. But basically, the world is taking a major turn, and it's important for people to understand the true nature of this turn. We're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back with the main body of tonight's installment of Radio Free America 37. We're going to begin now this particular installment of RFA 37, How the U.S. Lost the Second World War, by taking a look at one of the central concepts as we begin examining the events that took place in Germany during and after the Second World War. We're going to take a look at one of the central concepts involved in How the U.S. Lost the Second World War, namely the Christian West concept. This was a Third Reich contingency plan for surviving military defeat, and it provided for a Hitlerless Reich to join with the U.S. and Britain and France in a European anti-Soviet alliance, with Germany as the keystone to block Soviet expansion across the European continent. We're going to take a look now, by way of review, at the book The Old Boys, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. This book was authored by Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H, published by Charles Scribner's and Sons, copyright 1992. Now recall that the Christian West concept was being hammered out between German espionage agents who were also members of the transatlantic and financial industrial axis that I have examined in a number of archive shows, including this one, the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, the program about Japanese fascism. Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 10 go into this transatlantic industrial and financial axis. The main negotiators were, on the German side, a fellow named Giro von Gevernitz, related by marriage to the Stinnes family, and also a German, actually a member of the Habsburg family, a German nobleman named Prince Max Egon von Hohenlohe, a direct representative of the SS and specifically Amt 6 of the Sicherheitsdienst, headed up by Walter Schellenberg, That was the basically the Sicherheitsdienst was the SS intelligence service, and the Sicherheitsdienst and Amt 6 basically functioned as the, in effect the foreign affairs department of the SS. On the American side, the main negotiator was Alan Dulles, at the time the head of the Bern, Switzerland OSS office. The OSS was America's World War II intelligence service, and Alan Dulles himself, an individual who, through his involvement with the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, a senior partner in which was his brother John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles himself, a main player in this transatlantic industrial and financial axis. Turning now to the old boys. This is the Christian West concept, and the individual being quoted here is Alan Dulles. And we're going to take a look at Alan Dulles' ideas for a post-World War II Europe. They jibe very nicely with the ideas of the Third Reich, a Hitlerless Reich to join with the U.S., Britain, and France in an anti-Soviet alliance with Germany as the cornerstone. But bear in mind that the individual who we're going to be, whose ideas we're examining here, is Alan Dulles, later on, of course, director of the CIA, fired by President Kennedy. He then went on to become a key member of the Warren Commission. Reading now from the old boys. Pronouncements alternated with rich meals in a Liechtenstein chateau. Hohenlohe, bit by bit, expressed his quasi-official status as a spokesman for SS elements within the German government, who now looked beyond the, quote, wild men, unquote, in control. What casts a longer shadow is the outline of Allen's geopolitical ideas. The peace he has in mind, Dulles indicates, must avoid the excesses of Versailles and permit the expanded German polity to survive, Austria included, and possibly at least a section of Czechoslovakia, while excluding all thought of, quote, victors and vanquished as a factor of order and progress, unquote. Within this decentralized nation, the importance of Prussia must be reduced to ward off for the future. Dulles is quoted directly here, the, quote, inwardly unbalanced, inferiority complex-ridden Prussian militarism, unquote. The resultant, quote, greater Germany, unquote. Now, this is Alan Dulles, folks. Beginning again, the resultant, quote, greater Germany, unquote, would backstop the, again, quoting, formation of a cordon sanitaire against Bolshevism and Pan-Slavism through the eastward enlargement of Poland and the preservation of a strong Hungary, unquote. This, quote, federal Greater Germany, similar to the United States, with an associated Danube Confederation, would be the best guarantee of order and progress in Central and Eastern Europe. Skipping down, an Abwehr officer, F. Eustace von Einem, J-U-S-T-U-S-V-O-N, capital E-I-N-E-M, later claimed to have sat in on a carefully prepared meeting at Santander in Spain in the summer of 1943, during which both Menzies, a British representative, and Donovan agreed to Christian-Western terms as recapitulated by Canaris personally. If this exchange occurred, Donovan kept it quiet. Donovan, of course, was William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, himself a very powerful Wall Street lawyer, and whether or not, as F. Eustace von Einem claims here, the agreement was reached during World War II, it quite obviously was reached after World War II. Due to the fortunes of combat, it was not possible for the Christian West concept to be activated in such a way as to prevent the Soviet armies from occupying part of Germany. For the U.S. to have done that during the war would have been to invite mutiny, certainly by other allies, possibly even by elements of the American forces. However, it is quite obvious that the Christian West concept became the seed concept for NATO. And never forget that this was a Third Reich contingency plan for surviving what they saw as their inevitable military defeat. We're going to take a look now, very briefly, at an article from a Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 35, this from the fall of 1990. We have read this article into the record before, but by way of review, this article is called Reinhard Gehlen, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, by Carl Oglesby, a very fine researcher whose work I have accessed in the past. And this particular section of Oglesby's article It's basically a description of Reinhard Gehlen's view of what policies he and the Third Reich should take with regard to their impending military defeat. Now, recall, of course, that Reinhard Gehlen was the chief of Third Reich intelligence on the Eastern Front, the head of Fremdeheer Ost, or Foreign Armies East. After the war, he jumped to the CIA with his entire organization, complete and intact, a functioning Third Reich military and intelligence organization which functioned throughout the World War II period and continued on up through the post-World War II period as, first, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately the intelligence service of West Germany, the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, which it is to this day. It has survived some of its most junior members at the time, now in positions of authority, to this day. Now, in previous installments of RFA 37, we have seen how the Gehlen organization, acting in conjunction with powerful American political forces, corporate forces, national security forces, and political forces, ultimately led to the introduction of rollback or liberation theory, which had its genesis as a Third Reich psychological and political warfare program or tactic against the Soviet Union. How this eventually, as a result of the Crusade for Freedom, a domestic CIA propaganda campaign, led to the introduction of rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War, which entailed not only, quote, liberating, unquote, Eastern Europe from the Soviets, but the actual breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent ethnic republics, which has now, of course, occurred. Rollback or liberation theory evolved into a major element of American political thinking. It had its triumph, as we have seen, with the assassination of John Kennedy. At that point, rollback or liberation theory became ascendant. Its fulfillment came under the Reagan and Bush administrations. In addition to the introduction of rollback or liberation theory into American society as a major element of strategic and political thinking, the Crusade for Freedom campaign enabled Gehlen-related elements to be projected into positions of political leadership, first within some of the ethnic American voting blocks, Eastern European American voting blocks in the United States, and eventually the introduction of these elements evolved into the Republican Heritage Groups Council, in which many of these same Third Reich alumni and Eastern European fascist alumni were able to assume a very powerful position of leadership within the Republican Party proper. And ultimately we saw how some of these same elements were ultimately projected back into positions of, if not leadership, certainly political viability in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, when Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union have now been, the map of the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe has now been redrawn along precisely the lines foreseen by Rosenberg's Ostministerium during the Third Reich and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, an organization formed under Adolf Hitler in 1943, which evolved into a major element of the former World Anti-Communist League. Many of the same elements, such as the Iron Guard, the Ustashi, the OUNB group, the Bulgarian National Front, the Arrow Cross organization, are again active in parts of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union in some areas, such as Croatia, and the Ukraine. They are dominant. In others, they are active, not yet anyway, dominant elements in that part of the world. Slovakia, of course, is now an independent republic from Czechoslovakia, as it was under the Third Reich. And by way of taking a look at the long historical vision of the Gehlen organization and through Reinhard Gehlen and his organization, the Third Reich, let's turn to Oglesby's article. In a section of his article that he terms The Great Escape, Oglesby writes, "In December of 1943 at the latest, Gehlen reached the same conclusion about the war that had come upon Bormann, shocked Skorzeny and Himmler. Germany was losing and could do nothing about it. Several months later, Gehlen says, he began quietly discussing the impending defeat with a few close associates. As he writes in his memoir, quote, early in October 1944, I told my more intimate colleagues that I considered the war was lost and we must begin thinking of the future. We had to think ahead and plan for the approaching catastrophe, unquote. Galen's strategic response to Götterdämmerung was a kind of fusion of Himmler's philosophy with Bormann's more pessimistic Odessa line. Quote, "My view," he writes, again quoting, "was that there would be a place even for Germany in a Europe rearmed for defense against communism. Therefore, we must set our sights on the Western powers and give ourselves two objectives, to help defend against communist expansion and to recover and reunify Germany's lost territories," unquote. So quite obviously, the alliance with the Western powers, including and especially the United States, was foreseen by Reinhard Galen well before the end of the war as a strategic device for recovering Germany's lost territories. That has now been accomplished through the defeat of the United States, which was essentially used as a tool for German revival and eventually the recovery of Germany's lost territories. Now, when I speak of the United States as having been defeated, I want to reiterate, I am not speaking about a military defeat, obviously, not a defeat on the battlefield, but a political defeat and a consequent economic defeat. And bear in mind, too, that the Christian West concept was a Third Reich survival concept. Liberation theory was a Third Reich tactic. Both were realized, and ultimately liberation thinking had its triumph in the United States. That worked to the betterment of Germany and ultimately to the detriment of the United States. The full-court press strategy that was drawn up initially or envisioned in National Security Council 68, drawn up by Paul Nitze, did in fact fulfill its goal of bankrupting the Soviet Union. It also, in addition to bankrupting and dissolving the USSR, has bankrupted, if not yet dissolved, the United States. Bear in mind, too, two very, very important elements of the analysis that I'm presenting here. In the first place, bear in mind that a major strategic consideration of the Third Reich had been the use of anti-communism as a device for conquest. It was understood very early on by the German General Staff and the Nazi Party that the Western nations' fear of communism could be manipulated very effectively and cynically by the Third Reich as a device for ultimately conquering those countries. Bear in mind also my slight reversal of the very famous principle by Prussian military theoretician von Clausewitz. Von Clausewitz said, "War is the continuation of politics by other means." You will also see that translated as "war is the continuation of policy by other means." What I'm examining here, when I talk about the defeat of the United States, I am examining politics or policy as the continuation of war by other means. In order to understand the Galen organization and how it functioned as a Trojan horse within the United States, and bear in mind again that this organization was absolutely unique in human history. It was a Third Reich military organization, and beyond that, a highly sophisticated intelligence service which functioned continually throughout the Third Reich into the post-World War II period. It provided the United States with the vast bulk of its intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, much of it badly distorted, and it at the same time was serving as the de facto NATO intelligence organization. It was at the very core of the Christian West concept, and ultimately it became the West German intelligence service. But even when it was the BND continued to provide the United States with the vast bulk of its intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. It was a remarkable organization, and as we shall see, and have seen already to a considerable extent, it functioned as a Trojan horse within the United States, a major element for affecting the political defeat and the consequent economic defeat of the United States. In order to understand the Galen organization and how it functioned, we are, for the next several weeks, going to begin examining what was going on in Germany during and after World War II. First, we're going to take a look again at a book that we have already used at considerable length in RFA 37. This is a book largely unknown now, but very well known and very well respected at the time that it was published. The book is called The Nazis Go Underground. Its author was Kurt Ries, C-U-R-T-R-I-E-S-S. It was published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran & Company, and copyrighted 1944. What we're going to take a look at now is the fifth chapter, or a good portion of the fifth chapter of The Nazis Go Underground. It is entitled The Plan, and this is, and again, this information came from Western, from Allied intelligence sources, some of them connected with the resistance in Europe. This is the Third Reich's plan to survive military defeat. It entailed both the German government and the Nazi Party proper going underground. It entailed the cellular organization of both the German government and the party so that they could survive military defeat and occupation by the Allied powers. And these cells were to be very, very small. And in addition to having the cellular organization of both the party and the government affected so that it could go underground and continue to function, it should be noted that one of the central features of the Third Reich's survival plan was decentralization, whereas the Nazi Party and the German government in the Third Reich were highly centralized. The Third Reich, and in particular a fellow named Konstantin Hierl, H-I-E-R-L, foresaw that decentralization, extreme decentralization, would be the ideal method for surviving military defeat. Kurt Reiss, writes of this as follows in The Nazis Go Underground. The hand-picked staff selected personally by Heinrich Himmler worked hard in the offices at 11 Königsallee to complete the preparations necessary for building up and perfecting the machine which would have to function underground after the defeat. By the way, Königsallee is K-O-E-N-I-G-S-A-L-L-E. Himmler himself supervised and controlled their work from his headquarters at Prince Albrechtstrasse, at least up to November of 1943, when British bombs destroyed most of the building. Martin Bormann divided his time between his headquarters at the Chancellery, Himmler's office, and Königsallee. And from his desk at the Ministry of Economics, Konstantin Hierl contributed some very interesting detail work, which was to become an integral part of the whole scheme. By the way, that's K-O-N-S-T-A-N-T-I-N-H-I-E-R-L. That's the gentleman's name. And skipping down in the text, here is his plan. In July of 1943, he made an interesting statement to his most trusted lieutenants in the labor service in Munich. The party achieved its utmost power and its greatest influence during its legal period when it was centrally ruled. Never was a party more efficiently centralized than ours. The principle for the illegal period which will come after the war must, however, be utmost decentralization. In fact, we must decentralize to such a degree that we must seem to have disappeared. The 100 men who formerly marched through the street or attended a meeting will then be found in 100 different plants or offices in 100 different cities. Only thus can we survive, unquote. Decentralization means the application of the system of cells. To work out the theoretical part of installing them was the task of Herr Hierl. He had organized a similar system of cells for the party in the years 1931 and 1932. These secret cells never had to go into action at that time because the party was not forced underground. But they will have to go into action this time. And Konstantin Hierl has been working ever since the spring of 1943 at organizing them. They will have a great many new features as compared with the cells of 1931 and 32. The main new feature will be, to use Hierl's phrase, quote, complete decentralization, unquote. There will be no connection between the different cells, no go-betweens for many years after the party has submerged. The important thing for the members of these cells, according to Hierl, is to keep alive, to stay where they are, and to wait patiently. By the way, later on, when we jump ahead 17 years to the new Germany and the old Nazis, we will see that they did not have to wait very long at all. Continuing now with Kurt Reiss's text. The members of the cells will not know anything about the members of any other cells, not even that any other cells exist. Only a few leaders who will not be in Germany will have complete knowledge of how many men are available and where they are. And only they can get in touch with these men whenever it becomes necessary. Interrupting again, note that only a few leaders who will not be in Germany will know where the cells are. Continuing. cells will comprise no more than 3 to 6 men. Only in a very few exceptional cases will cells of 10 men be permitted, and that only later. In the beginning, according to Hirl, no such exception will be made, no unnecessary risks taken. Himmler and Hirl hope that in this way, between 200,000 and 300,000 men will be hidden away within German plants, factories, city administrations, etc. Next, we're going to take a look at Himmler's plan to have the German government go underground by basically having a number of different innocent-seeming departments infiltrated with these particular cells of these Nazi cells, and also having the Nazi Party simplify itself into a few departments which also would go underground and would be organized cellularly. Of the plan to have the party go underground, Kurt Rees writes, Himmler's overall plan divides itself into two parts, one dealing with ways and means for the government to go underground, the other with ways and means for the party to go underground. As to the government, the following system has been worked out. Out of the countless offices or sub-departments of each ministry, 2 or 3 departments have been chosen in which underground work will be continued after the end of this war. These departments, all of them outwardly of a harmless nature, have been filled with dependable Nazis, and new men who have been trained in underground work are constantly being added. Each department will be infiltrated with at least 10 cells consisting of 2 persons each, a so-called A man and a so-called B man. The A man is supposed to keep the contact with the higher ups and the government, the B man with the underground, that is, the illegal part of the movement. Each such government department has, therefore, been duplicated in such a way that for each man there exists a reserve man who may supplant him at any given time for any reason whatsoever. The following departments have been chosen for this type of infiltration. The list does not pretend to be complete for obvious reasons. By the way, I'm only going to read the English names. There are some very complicated German names, and by way of simplifying here, I'm just going to read the English names. Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Cultural Department, Ministry of the Interior, Communal Department, Department of Health, and the Department of Surveys, Ministry of Economics, Statistical Department, which in a way will become a center of its own whose function will be discussed later, and also the Mining Security Department. Now again, when it says here, for example, Ministry of Foreign Affairs will become the Cultural Department, Ministry of the Interior, the Communal Department, and Department of Surveys, these are the innocent departments which will in fact serve to continue the Nazi government, now not the party, but the government, in an underground fashion. And again, the cells will have an A man who will keep contact with the government, and a B man who will keep contact with the Nazi party that will go underground and will also be organized cellularly. Continuing, Ministry of Labor, Social Insurance Department, Public Welfare Department, Government Insurance Department, Ministry of Justice, the Railway Court, and the Government Patent Office, Air Ministry, Department of Meteorology. This department will be under direct supervision of the underground army to be, the Ministry of Posts, the Central Post Office, and the Government Printing Office, the Ministry of Traffic, the Department of Canals, the Ministry of Agriculture, the Department for Agricultural Experiments, the Ministry of Culture. The Nazis will attempt to use this entire ministry for their underground. For some time, it has been rumored that this ministry is really not Nazi at all. Many anti-Nazis firmly believe and even assert that it is opposed to everything the propaganda ministry does. The propaganda ministry, of course, will have to be sacrificed. But the Nazis hope that the occupying powers will believe the lie that the Ministry of Culture represents a spirit of Goethe, Bach, and Beethoven, and must not be disturbed in its attempts to re-educate the Germans. The Ministry of Culture will also function as a means of contact between the Nazi underground and certain industrialists. The departments particularly suited to this purpose are the Technische Reichsanstalt, the TE, that's TECHNISCHEREICHSANSTALT, the Technische Reichsanstalt, that is the Government Technical Institute, and the Technische Reichenstadt, the Institute for Chemical Technology, and the Reichenstadt für Erdbebenforschungen, that is Erdbebenforschung, the Institute for Seismology. It may seem strange that such departments should exist within the framework of the Ministry of Culture, but they do, and they have precious little to do with Goethe, Bach, or Beethoven. They furnish the ideal contact point between the Nazis and industry. The Ministry of Economics, which would seem to be the logical department for such a contact, will not be used for this purpose at all. This would be too obvious. The Ministry of Culture will also supervise and create a great number of cultural clubs all over Germany, which will be excellently suited to serve as fronts for the Nazis. So note here the profound role of the Ministry of Culture, and note also that contacts with major German industrialists will be maintained, according to the contingency plan, as we saw last week in sections of both Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Radio Free America number 2. These industrialists were in fact put right back in power thanks to the good graces of many of their American counterparts who had been involved in business dealings with them before and during World War II. Again, that's the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I have alluded to so many times. That axis is central to the entire working hypothesis of Radio Free America 37, and as we examine events in Germany during the coming weeks, bear in mind that the Third Reich industrialists and financiers were put right back in power, because that is a cornerstone of everything we will be examining in the weeks to come.